So many people have told me many of you have told me that you would like to be the one to introduce Paul Springer, but you know, I know, Angela.
Revenge is an ugly thing.
No, I think it's an honor, and I get that for being the sponsoring institution or something. So here it goes. Paul J. Springer is a full professor of comparative military studies at the Air Command and Staff College, and also the chair of the Department of Research at the same institution. He holds a PhD in history from Texas A&M University, and has previously taught at the United States
Military Academy. I think it's missing a line there.
It is.
I don't know.
You
why.
Gave it away, Paul.
Because I don't want people to think
they
I taught
supposed
at the U.S.
To
military
know.
Machines.
They're not supposed to know you wrote this.
It's okay. They know how my ego works.
Okay, so he doesn't want me to read what's literally written here, which is, I see now, the United States military machines. He wants me to read the United States Military Academy, and then what is the next line?
I think it's referring to a book called Outsourcing War to Machines.
Outsourcing?
War to Machines.
Outsourcing
War
to Machines. The Military Robotics Revolution will be published in early 2018. So those of you who want to know the latest word from Paul Springer in print is, repeat the title again.
Outsourcing War to Machines.
Outsourcing War to Machines will be published in early 2018. Does it have a press?
Wait for the paperback.
Wait for the paperback, he says. He has previously published one book on military robotics, two on cyber warfare, and one on terrorism. Of relevance to this conference are his works, America's Captives, Treatment of PhDs, Prisoners of War, Not AKA PhDs, Treatment of POWs from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror, and also Transforming Civil War Prisons, Lincoln, Lieber, and the Laws of War, co-authored by Dr. Glenn Robbins. He edits two series, The History of Military Aviation and Transforming War for the Naval Institute Press, and is a senior fellow of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. And tonight he will be speaking on Forgotten Casualties, Prisoners of War in Modern Warfare. Big hand to Paul.
So those of you that don't know me, I do keep things fairly informal, and I apologize for that. Leanne, I'm impressed that you actually did not just slap me there. I'd like to thank the organizers of the conference for putting this conference together. It's been fantastic so far. I think tomorrow is also going to be great. The papers today were outstanding. It's just wonderful to see people paying attention to these issues. And I am here to essentially tell you that there's nothing more to write about. So, stick with the past, because the future's not going to turn out well. Yeah, well, there's a downer. I told you to start drinking. So when I started working on this, and we were kicking some titles and some ideas around, and I said, well, Forgotten Casualties. This will be a good catch-all title. But you know how it is when you start with one plan. You start to say something, and it comes out differently than what you initially intended. So, for example, this morning, my wife said to me, hey, would you please pass the salt? But it came out, you ruined my life, you bastard. So where this wound up going and where I'm going to take you tonight is some kind of dark places. And for that, I apologize. I need to start out with a full disclosure. I do work for the federal government, and everything I have to say is not remotely sanctioned by them. The DOD, the Air University, the United States Air Force, Air Command and Staff College, they will all disavow everything that I have to say. And if you don't like it, so will I. So just a heads up that this is entirely my own opinion. I don't always do these disclosures, but when I see that I'm being videotaped, I absolutely do. Because I would like to wave to our future overlords. All right, here's the fundamental question of this conference. Why do we take prisoners? What is the utility associated with even the notion of a prisoner of war? You can understand the utility of surrendering to an enemy, especially if it's that or die, But the fundamental question becomes, why do we take prisoners? And that's something that we've been wrestling with for thousands of years. And I'm here to argue that in the 21st century, we're facing a significant paradigm shift in the answer to this particular question. So if we do a quick and dirty overview, you know, we can say, for example, the Romans took prisoners for a number of reasons. The Roman Republic and the Roman Empire engaged in a whole series of warfare. And over the course of their wars, their behavior towards captured enemies changed. In some part, the Romans took captives because they could enslave them, so there was an economic aspect to things. The Romans also liked to take captives so that they could parade them through the streets of Rome and show the military prowess of both their military and their commanders to the Roman people. It was a way of saying, we're keeping you safe, and we are powerful, and we are unstoppable. And early on, those prisoners tended to have a pretty ugly end. Typically, they were paraded in a triumph, and then they were just quietly strangled, actually, in the underground of the city, and their bodies were disposed of. Over time, we see them being used for more diverting issues. So, for example, a handful of them might have been used as gladiators to fight to the death for the amusement of everyone else. Well, why do they do that? They do that to divert the population from all of the horrible things that are going on in the empire. We don't really see the massive rise of this use of prisoners for diversion until the empire really starts to have fundamental internal problems. Sometimes you take prisoners as a means of coercion. So, for example, if we look at the Battle of Clydeion in the year 1014, we have the Byzantines fighting against the upstart Bulgarians. And at the end of the battle, the Byzantines reportedly took 14,000 prisoners. They divided them into lots of 100, and within those groups of 100, all of the prisoners would draw lots. The lucky one got stabbed in the eye. The unlucky other 99 got stabbed in both eyes. So the one with one eye left had to lead his 99 compatriots back home to show what happens when you pick a fight with the Byzantine Empire. It was fairly effective. Allegedly, Tsar Samuel, leader of the Bulgarians, had a heart attack when he witnessed what had happened to the remnants of his army. Very effective. And you didn't have a whole lot more fighting between the Bulgarians and the Byzantines after this message had been delivered. Shift to the Crusades, and we sometimes see POWs being used as a very abject form of diplomacy. When Richard the Lionheart demanded concessions from his enemies, and those concessions were not delivered, he began to execute Muslim prisoners to show his resolve. In retaliation, Saladin carried out a mass execution after a significant victory at the Battle of Hattin. Sometimes prisoners were taken for ransom. So King John II at Poitiers was taken prisoner. He was released on a promise that he would deliver 3 million crowns to secure his own release. When he could not raise the money, he actually went back into captivity amongst the English. Sometimes we see prisoners being taken in order to support religion. For example, the Aztecs believed that they needed to sacrifice human captives in order to keep their gods appeased. In the year 1487, according to Aztec records, they sacrificed 84,000 enemy prisoners in a 4-day span in order to reconsecrate their primary temple. Now, it's almost certain that those numbers are inflated, but those numbers came from somewhere. And what we see looking at Aztec records is that they had to keep themselves essentially in a perpetual state of war with all of their neighbors in order to make certain that they had enough captives to satisfy their bloodthirsty gods. In Europe, we sometimes saw prisoners being taken as a form of messaging. In the 30 Years' War, for example, sometimes prisoners were taken for ransom, sometimes they were taken for exchange, and sometimes they were executed out of hand. It all depended on whether the captors thought there was more benefit to taking prisoners than there was to killing them off. Given the amount of economic damage that the 30 Years' War did, it should come as no surprise that over time, the practice of taking prisoners gradually began to decline. At the end of that war, one of its former prisoners who managed to survive the experience, Hugo de Grotius, began to write about what he considered to be the duty of all belligerent states to engage in warfare in a moral fashion. And he claimed that prisoners of war needed to be considered in the possession of the state that captured them, not the individual units or the individual fighters. His arguments gradually began to carry weight, as did his intellectual descendants, such as Vattel and Montesquieu, both of whom talked about the limits of warfare and the necessity of imposing morality and the concept of what you can and cannot do in war. This is important to us, because when you look at the different conflicts that have dominated our discussions so far today, and the different conflicts that we're going to be talking about tomorrow, they tend to have been fought with a common assumption about what the rules of war are. And a lot of those assumptions were in place before there was any effort to create an international codification of what the limits might be. So, when we reach the United States Civil War, for example, what we see is a common understanding that when an enemy offers to lay down their arms, you had a moral duty to accept that surrender, that you could not execute your enemies out of hand. And upon accepting that surrender, you would then care for that captive, hold on to that captive, protect their safety, and await exchange. We created entire tables for how to equate prisoners of different ranks. We created exchange systems. But you've got to start thinking about the fundamental reality behind this. If in the modern era, and I count the Civil War as being a modern war, the only way to truly destroy a major enemy force is not through battle, but rather through surrender, it stands to reason that exchange is an irrational act. Our assumptions of the time were that individuals that were captured would be returned to their original state of service, and by extension, they would almost certainly see service once again on the battlefields, which would then require you to apply even more force to either bring about their surrender or their destruction. Thus, in many ways, it made more sense to remove prisoners from the battlefield and keep them from the battlefield for the duration of the conflict. And that's part of the reason that Francis Lieber argued that while exchange in wartime was permissible, it should not be considered the norm in modern warfare. Now, Francis Lieber was a very ardent unionist, and part of his argument surrounded the notion that because the Union was on the offensive from a strategic perspective for most of the war, particularly after the exchange system broke down, it stood to reason that every Confederate defender returned to the battlefield might very well cost the lives of more than one Union troop in overwhelming him once again. So Lieber is making the case that having attrited the enemy forces through surrender and through violence, one should not return their forces back to them and allow them to engage in violence upon your forces once again. By the time of the 20th century, that assumption has become the norm. We're taking prisoners in World War I and we're taking prisoners in World War II, but we're not engaging in mass exchanges between the sides. Rather, we're pulling those forces back from the battlefields. We're essentially removing them from the calculus of victory. And while they might require some economic upkeep, if they can be used for labor to at least offset the costs associated with holding them, they essentially become a zero-sum game. It might not be a matter of victory so much as simply buying time for your remaining forces to obtain victory. Now, that's not true everywhere. That is certainly a Western assumption. And when you look at the conflict on the Eastern Front in World War II, for example, what we see is the utilization of prisoners for slave labor and mass executions, such that 90% of all prisoners taken on the Eastern Front do not survive the experience. And those Germans that do survive Soviet captivity, most of them are not returned to Germany until after 1950. We, in fact, see the last of them going home in 1956. So this assumption that they're no longer an object of exchange, they're no longer a mechanism by which you might regain some of your forces, which, at least in theory, you inherently value more than the forces of the enemy, has really gone by the wayside by the early 20th century. So why do we take prisoners? Why not continue to fight it out? Well, in the post-World War II period, the United States gets in a number of conflicts, and a lot of those conflicts are deeply rooted in ideological concerns. For example, when the United States leads the United Nations command in its conflict in Korea, we are largely doing so out of an assumption that one must stop the spread of communism, this ideology that is determined to bring down all of the institutions that we most value. We operate under the assumption that all communists think alike, that they're all orchestrated by one controlling force, that the Kremlin is using these communist forces to gradually bring down the West. And that's an assumption that's rooted in reality. The fact of the matter is, as we see things, in the post-World War II period, there is a substantial growth in the number of individuals living in countries ruled by communist regimes. And as the numbers change, and as the communists argue that the most important form of capital that they possess is human capital, it only stands to reason that at the very least, we need to try to stop the spread of this ideology. We've abandoned the possibility of eliminating it by force. That's going to become important to us in the 21st century. So please keep that in the back of your mind. The other thing I want you to keep in the back of your mind is that World War II was the last time that the United States declared war. And a formal international declaration of war is an important thing. It carries a lot of weight. It brings with it some baggage, but it also brings with it some assumptions. Domestically, it's also very important. When the United States declares war, for all intents and purposes, the United States president becomes a dictator. There is nothing within the Constitution that formally enumerates any limitations upon presidential power in wartime. And it's also important to consider. According to the United States Constitution, it is the legislature that declares war, but it is the presidency that negotiates treaties. So hypothetically, if the legislature declares war and the president refuses to negotiate peace, there's no end to the conflict. There's no constitutional mechanism for the legislature to end a declared war. The only thing that the legislature can do is ratify a peace treaty. And that should make you real nervous with where we're going. Allow me to pause for effect. Or because I'm thirsty. So, moving on to Korea. In Korea, we see some very unique behaviors. In particular, we don't know it at the time, but there are an awful lot of individuals that are deliberately surrendering to UN forces for the very purpose of getting into the POW compounds. And once there, they are organizing prisoners to cause as many disruptions as possible. Their goal is to create atrocities, to provoke incidents that can then be used for propaganda on the world stage and undercut the United Nations position. They managed to orchestrate a number of uprisings, and in one very embarrassing case, POWs managed to capture a brigadier general, their camp commandant, who agreed to walk into the prison compound unarmed and unguarded to negotiate with the prisoners under his control over the conditions of their captivity. Very bad idea. Now, it's impressive the amount of material that these prisoners are smuggling into the camp. For example, the fact that they managed to have a poster of Joseph Stalin inside the compound, and it's not something that they produced out of watercolors in there. This is something that was pre-printed and brought in on a number of occasions. Indicated to us that there were a number of agitators that were deliberately jumping inside our lines as a means to cause havoc behind the lines. We saw the same behavior in Vietnam. In Vietnam, we thought that we could control this by putting all of the prisoners on the island of Phu Quoc. It didn't work. It turns out they were perfectly capable of agitating and drawing international attention. The media was more than happy to broadcast a lot of their messages. Now, by the time of Vietnam, we thought the primary purpose of capturing enemy prisoners was not labor, and it was not necessarily attrition of the enemy forces, and it certainly for us was not propaganda. It was their intelligence value. Whatever information they might possess, we hoped to wring out of them, particularly those that seemed to be particularly knowledgeable of insurgent activities. It didn't go well. The International Committee of the Red Cross condemned the United States on a number of occasions, particularly for the excesses of our South Vietnamese allies, who were perfectly willing to apply force and torture as a means of extracting information. Now, why were they willing to do that? Was it just that they didn't have respect for the sanctity of human life? I would argue no. The South Vietnamese, in their own minds, and as events proved, they were right, they thought they were fighting a war of national survival. And if you consult the theorists of just war, they would tell you that in a war of national survival, morality effectively goes out the window. If your choice is regime collapse or torture or really almost any other form of atrocity, the just war theorists allow for those behaviors. And the South Vietnamese government really is facing a war of annihilation. But the United States is not. And so the United States is using its influence to try to mitigate some of the behaviors of the South Vietnamese, on the assumption that we will always be there to defend them, and therefore that they need to use a light touch. As we all know, it did not turn out well. Now, by 1991, we have an interesting dynamic. Because in the Gulf War, you have a coalition on one side, and you have the Iraqi army on the other, and both sides are fighting under the assumption that this is a conventional struggle between professional forces, and therefore, prisoners of war will be taken. The same cannot necessarily be said for Saddam Hussein and some of his chief lieutenants. There's a number of allegations of mistreatment of American captives, but on the whole, the Iraqi behavior is not nearly as bad as we thought that it was going to be. For our side of things, the International Committee of the Red Cross proclaimed that the 1991 treatment of Iraqi captives was the greatest POW treatment plan in the history of warfare, which sets a pretty high bar for everything that's going to follow. Now, the United States didn't actually plan very well for the Iraqi captives. We largely outsourced their treatment to the Saudis, who agreed to rush the necessary supplies to the area and take over control of guarding Iraqi prisoners as soon as we were certain they did not possess any significant intelligence value. The very first Iraqi prisoners are actually given blueprints and a bunch of construction materials and asked to construct their own camp. To their credit, they actually followed the blueprints. They didn't build in any trapdoors or, you know, any cool little ways to escape, because at the end of the day, they really didn't want to escape. This was a pretty sweet deal for them. Sit out the war, eat some food, don't get shot. That felt like a win. And so a lot of them are actually pointing out flaws in the plans, saying, you know, somebody could squirm out there. We better shore that up with a little more wire and, you know, let's be safe. Let's make sure nothing bad happens. It is hilarious, actually, if you look at some of the accounts of this. But what we don't see is a lot of ideological dispute here. What we see is all of a sudden, great, we're back in modern war. The Cold War is ending. And therefore, we can now go back to fighting conflicts the good old-fashioned way, where we win and we take prisoners and everybody's friends and we hug it out at the end. That doesn't last very long. The United States winds up getting involved in the Balkans. There's not a lot of prisoner taking there. Three Americans are captured in one really strange incident in Kosovo. Those three individuals wind up being released by the Serbian government upon the appeal of Jesse Jackson, who took it upon himself to go and fetch the prisoners. Now, it was one of the weirder days of my life when I woke up and I grabbed the Des Moines Register, Des Moines, Iowa, small little town, and staring at me from the front page is one of my college buddies. He was one of the three prisoners that had been taken by the Serbs. It was very bizarre. But he was released a few days later, completely unharmed. Everything was fine. So good. We're in this brave new world where everybody's moral again, and we can all be happy. Or not. Because after 9/11, we get ourselves engaged in a conflict with Afghanistan, and we do a lot of hand-wringing about whether or not these are even prisoners of war, these individuals that we capture. If they are, in theory, we have to follow the Geneva Conventions. If they're not, we don't, but if we treat them as non-POWs, they really have very little incentive to surrender, whereas if we treat them as POWs, that really limits all the naughty things we'd like to do to them. So we find ourselves in a little bit of a legal gray area, and we start asking ourselves, why are we taking prisoners exactly? And the answer we keep coming back to is, we take prisoners because we have to. We take prisoners because the laws say you gotta take prisoners if they offer up their surrender. And President Bush announces, look, they don't fit the requirements of the Geneva Convention. Okay, the Geneva Convention has four main provisions. You must bear arms openly. You must wear a uniform or recognizable device. You must be part of a hierarchical organization where the leadership is responsible for the behavior of subordinates. And you must follow the laws of war. And quite frankly, Al-Qaeda fails on all four fronts. But President Bush said, look, we're still going to treat them largely in accordance with the Geneva Convention. Not exactly, but more or less. We're going to make sure they're fed. We're not going to torture them. We're going to not subject them to all kinds of horrible things. Yes, we will interrogate them, but we're going to treat them relatively well because we don't really know what else to do. We're engaged in this ground fight in Afghanistan, and we've been telling our troops for decades, if somebody surrenders, you must take their surrender. And this is creating a moral quandary for us, because what do you do with all those prisoners? You're making war on an ideology, not a state. So how do you declare victory? And at what point do the repatriation clauses of the Geneva Convention kick in? And when and if those repatriation clauses kick in, exactly where do you repatriate these individuals to? Because most of the ones that we're capturing and bringing out of theater are not from Afghanistan. And it turns out an awful lot of the countries they are from do not want these people back. The old not my problem doctrine starts to kick in. No, we won't take them. If you send them back to us, we will refuse them entry. If you force their entry, we will execute them upon receipt. And that makes us kind of uncomfortable. So now we've got a problem. Because we've got all these prisoners in Guantanamo, and we don't really know what to do with them. And we agree there are a lot of them that we probably don't really need to hang on to. But we need somebody else to agree to take them. We're not planting American citizens in Guantanamo Bay. The handful of Americans that we've captured in the war on terror, we tend to bring back to the United States. And we put them on trial for treason or other crimes. We hope that they will plead out to lesser charges. John Walker Lind, for example, becomes eligible for parole relatively soon, because he pled to a host of lesser charges so we didn't have to have a big public trial. I have no idea what that guy's going to say when he gets out of prison. But with the Guantanamo prisoners, a lot of times we don't know what to do with them. So our default answer becomes, well, hold on to them, I guess. And we vet them and we try to send some of them back. But a lot of them are just kind of sitting down in Guantanamo. Because after all, the war against Al-Qaeda continues, and therefore, we don't have to repatriate them yet. And, of course, as I mentioned, their countries don't want them back. Now, every once in a while, we get lucky. Every once in a while, a different country steps up with a really weird solution. So, for example, the Pacific island of Palau stepped in and said, hey, we know you've got a bunch of Uyghurs from Western China that have been fighting on behalf of Al-Qaeda, and we know you don't want to give them back to China because the Chinese government says they're going to execute them. Why don't you just send them to Palau? And we said, well, what are you going to do with them? And they said, we're going to set them free. But we won't let them have passports, and we won't let them leave the island. So, okay. We sent them 15 Uyghurs. And there was a really nice Time magazine expose on these individuals swimming in the surf and perfectly happy, until these individuals realized the government of Palau wasn't going to give them anything. You now live in Palau. You're going to need a job. You're going to have to find something you can do to contribute, or you're going to slowly starve to death. Those are pretty much your choices. And so most of them wind up actually working what we would class minimum wage unskilled jobs, you know, just enough to get by. I'm not sure you really count them as productive citizens of Palau, but they're functional. And if we could have gotten 50 other countries to step up and do the exact same thing, problem solved. But we can't. And so we wind up in this legal limbo where we can't quite figure out what to do with these individuals, but we are pretty sure we don't want more of them because they're expensive and they're kind of vaguely embarrassing. Speaking of embarrassing, You know what's more embarrassing? What's more embarrassing is when you get caught making a naked pyramid pile of enemy POWs, you get caught beating them, you get caught attaching them to electrodes, and these individuals, unlike the ones at Guantanamo Bay, undoubtedly fall under the Geneva Convention. This is Abu Ghraib. And Abu Ghraib is so embarrassing for the United States. When this starts getting out on this new internet thing, when this starts getting out on the social media sites, and when major media sites start picking this up and pointing out what's going on, we start asking ourselves again, why did we take these prisoners in the first place? We crammed 8,000 people into a civil prison complex, which, by the way, is only allowed as a temporary expedient in the Geneva Convention. You're not supposed to put them in a formal prison because you have a tendency to treat them like prisoners then, as opposed to prisoners of war. And the 800th Military Police Brigade that was responsible for guarding these individuals at Abu Ghraib, almost entirely composed of prison guards. They're a National Guard unit full of prison guards from Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, who view POWs as convicts, not enemy captives. Then they start coming under mortar fire every night, and they don't have any heavy weapons, and they don't have any vehicles at the prison, so they have no mechanism to respond to any of the attacks they're being subjected to. And not surprisingly, they take out their frustrations and irritations upon the only target in their vicinity, the POWs. It's an ugly mess. It makes the United States look absolutely terrible. It really upsets our coalition allies who are all saying, look, we let you be in charge of prisoners because you said you could handle it. This is not handling it. And so we began to wonder, is it possible to fight a war without taking prisoners? Now let's talk about the current opposition. Surrendering to the Islamic State is a really bad idea, because members of the Islamic State do not see prisoners as a means of exchange. They do not see prisoners as something that they are bound to take from either legal or moral reasons. Rather, they see prisoners as an opportunity to demonstrate their resolve. They see prisoners as an opportunity to terrorize the enemy. They see them as a way of coercing enemy nations, recruiting new members. They see them, in short, as a wonderful bonanza for terror attacks. And they have done horrible things to their captives. They have burned them alive. They have beheaded them. They have drowned them. They have buried them alive. They have gotten incredibly creative in the means by which they execute enemy captives. So you can't count on them to agree to one-to-one exchanges. The changing speed of warfare means it's highly unlikely if you capture a member of the Islamic State that they're going to have any form of intelligence that's valuable for more than a few hours. So again, we start to ask ourselves, why are we even taking prisoners? And then there's Bo Bergdahl, who's a special case. Bergdahl walked away from his unit. He's been in the news again lately. Initially, there was a lot of question as to whether Bergdahl had been captured or whether he was a deserter. Now, the court of public opinion for certain has come down on the side of desertion, and he has pled guilty to having walked away from his unit. But at the time that Bergdahl was being held captive, the United States was absolutely determined to get him back regardless of the cost, whether that meant sending thousands of people on search missions, whether that meant paying an enormous ransom to individuals who claimed to be holding him, or whether that meant the eventual solution on March 31st, 2014, of exchanging him for five senior commanders of enemy forces. The United States allowed Bergdahl to be used as a hostage. Now, to a certain extent, our code requires us to keep the faith. We have to do everything in our power to get our forces back. And at the time of the Bergdahl exchange, I got a very strange phone call from Rear Admiral John Kirby, who was then serving as the departmental spokesperson for the Department of Defense. And he said, hey, you're the POW guy, right? And I went, not normally how I define myself, but sure. And he said, look, I'm giving a press briefing in 2 hours. We just got Bo Bergdahl back, and I need you to give me a quick and dirty summary of every time the United States has ever paid more than we got back in prisoner exchanges. So, all right, I'm a minion of the Department of Defense. I'm an academic. Sure thing. I whip it together as fast as I can. I send it off to him, and he goes out and he gives his briefing. Does he give me a conversational footnote? No, he does not. But I was proud to say there was one thing I put in there that he actually used and that President Obama then slipped into a speech on it a couple days later. Again, no credit for me. But that credit was, we don't outsource the punishment of desertion to our enemies. We will trade to get him back if only to hold him accountable for his own behavior. But by paying 5-1, and we didn't give back 5 sergeants, we gave back 5 senior commanders, we effectively declared open kidnapping season on American troops. We put our own forces at enormous risk because we demonstrated what we were willing to pay to get them back. Now, in some ways, we were following the lead of one of our favorite allies in the Middle East, Israel, which had paid 1,200 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for a single IDF soldier. And they had done so largely due to public pressure to get Gilad Shalit back. Feel free to Google it. It's a fascinating story. But understand, by making that exchange, we largely abandoned the precepts of how exchange and repatriation work. And in that regard, we were largely playing into the longer-term strategy of the enemies that we face. Now, this is a very popular political cartoon. And it demonstrates some of the frustration of American service personnel who feel like they're being forced to fight under a different set of circumstances than the enemy. It's not a fair comparison. At the end of the day, the United States must uphold the rule of law because the enemy does not. The enemy is absolutely determined to create a caliphate, a unified Islamic state, which, if brought into being, would, at least in the minds of Al-Qaeda and Islamic State leadership, look a lot like this. Now think about the population that this would encompass. You would instantly create a new superpower in terms of economy, in terms of population demographics, in terms of key vital geographic positions on Earth. And none of the other superpowers can possibly tolerate the emergence of this caliphate without fighting. Those biggest 5 powers on Earth, the ones that have UN Permanent Security Council vetoes, cannot tolerate the emergence of this caliphate. The Islamic State knows that. Al-Qaeda knows that. Which means they realize the only way the caliphate can come into being is by pulling down the current existing world order. They must destroy the United Nations. They must destroy the existing assumptions about human interactions and conflict. That is a major ambition. But one of the smaller aspects of that is destroying things like the laws of armed conflict, wiping them out. And the only way to do that is with the consent of those states that currently choose to follow them, including the United States. Now, for our part, the United States has spent a long time trying to engage in riskless war, trying to minimize the political costs of engaging in conflict. And that's why things like the MQ-9 Reaper are the face of modern war. The United States much prefers to engage in war at a distance, and whenever possible, not to place our own forces in harm's way. Consider the case of the Special Forces troops ambushed in Niger. How much attention has the death of a handful of service personnel garnered? We have one individual who has now occupied the attention of the president for a very long period of time. And it's not to say that the death of that service personnel is not a tragedy. Of course it is. But consider that to the types of news reports you would have seen in World War II. When you have individuals that are becoming an unacceptable cost for conflict, that tells you that the expectation is perfection, that you fight without losing a single soldier. And at the same time, the United States does not declare war anymore. but we engage in war. We do things that can only be defined as acts of war. An airstrike that kills enemy citizens is by definition an act of war, and it is something that we choose to do. We justify it by saying that we are pursuing members of Al-Qaeda, members of the Islamic State, and that may be a perfectly acceptable justification. I am not here to tell you that what we're doing is morally wrong. I'm not even here to tell you that what we're doing is legally wrong. What I'm here to tell you is we have deliberately chosen a mechanism of war that does not permit the taking of prisoners. So when you start looking at the biggest targets in the war on terror, this is a war of individuals. This is an effort to destroy organizations by killing the leadership. In my opinion, there was no circumstance by which Osama bin Laden was going to survive the raid in which he was killed. Because if he had, it would have been open season on Americans, not just personnel in the services, but every American citizen on earth would have been at risk of being taken as a hostage to attempt to secure the release of Osama bin Laden. And Al-Qaeda certainly proved that it had the global reach necessary to put virtually anyone at risk anytime. Osama bin Laden had to die, because if he was taken prisoner, there was no way that you could possibly hold him. No government could withstand the pressure associated with attempting to put him on trial, allowing him a platform with which to present his arguments. Had he attempted to surrender, had he come out with his hands up at the first sign of any kind of a raid, it is my contention he would still be dead. Now, war in the 21st century, it's becoming more and more non-human. In 1981, the Iraqis were building a nuclear reactor. Not surprisingly, the Israelis objected to that plan, and they decided it would be a good idea to launch an airstrike to destroy the reactor. The message to Iraq being, we can wipe out your nuclear program anytime we feel like it, so feel free to keep investing money in that program, and we will feel free to keep hitting it. There is some question as to whether the Saudis were complicit in that strike or whether the Saudis just had no idea that the Israelis were flying over their airspace. In large part, it doesn't matter. In 2007, the Syrians had a nuclear reactor. They were working on a nuclear program. That's another state that has vowed the destruction of Israel. The Israelis launched a massive airstrike, but there was a fundamental difference. The Syrians expected the airstrike. They had invested in a first-rate integrated air defense system. And the Israelis took that system down with a targeted cyber attack, which spoofed an empty radar return. Effectively, they rendered their warplanes invisible to the Syrian systems. The first hint the Syrians had that they were under attack was the detonation of airdropped munitions on their nuclear reactor. Now, it was an illegal reactor. The Syrian response was not to protest and not to launch a counterstrike. The Syrian response was to bulldoze the site and pretend it never existed. But they're not the only individuals in the area that hate the Israelis and have been building nuclear weapons. Iran has been building a site at Natanz for a long time, and the Israelis know it. And the Israelis did a couple of demonstration air defense exercises where they flew out into the western Mediterranean using tanker aircraft, and they flew the exact distance in the opposite direction as Natanz would be for an airstrike. And they were trying to demonstrate that they had the capability to hit Natanz. The United States, which was in possession of Iraqi airspace, denied them overflight permission. The only way the Israelis could pull off this strike would be to fly through Iraqi territory, and the U.S. said no. But somebody came up with a different solution. Somebody thought it would be a good idea to create a malicious cyber program and load it onto flash drives. And then just, oops, dropped a flash drive in the parking lot on my way to my car. And the lanyard says, Natanz Nuclear Enrichment Facility. Somebody else comes along, picks it up, and goes, huh, somebody dropped their stuff and plugged it into their computer. And the moment they did that, they uploaded Stuxnet. the most sophisticated cyber attack that the world had ever seen. I don't know that it was the Israelis. The New York Times says it was a joint Israeli-American operation. Nobody has ever formally claimed credit for Stuxnet. But I can tell you as a cyber expert, this required the resources of a nation state. This was not somebody in mom and dad's basement eating Cheetos, mainlining Mountain Dew, and hacking together a code to bring down the Iranian nuclear facilities. This was a concentrated intelligence asset putting together a plan. And what they managed to do was effectively engage in an act of war without having a single human being at risk, without having a single human being involved. It's an impressive display, but it reminds us that in the 21st century, there are many more avenues to achieve what you want through violence than simply massing your forces and invading an enemy country. The other direction we're going, quite frankly, and I certainly didn't want to go too deep down this rabbit hole, is military robotics. We are building fully autonomous, lethal systems that are capable of conducting warfare without human beings deliberately directing them and without human beings pulling the trigger. And that's important to us because that, in many ways, is the ideal. I can fight a war and the enemy can't kill any of my personnel. What a wonderful opportunity. You'll never take any of my troops prisoner because they're robots. What are you going to do, torture them for information? But if we don't think this through, if we don't consider the ramifications of allowing machines to kill human beings, we run the risk of opening the door to a much worse form of warfare. I appreciate the opportunity to come out and talk. I'm happy to take whatever questions I can. Thanks for your time. Sir. So there's a rumor that Baghdadi intentionally got himself captured, was held by coalition forces so that he could organize personnel within the prison systems to do jailbreaks, to become more radicalized. You don't really need somebody to organize you to become more radicalized in an Iraqi prison. It's not a pleasant place to be. In my opinion, this is Baghdadi whitewashing his own official story. Baghdadi declared himself to be the caliph, the proclaimed one selected by Allah. He can't, in that story, have done anything unintentionally. He can't have been swept up in a raid. He has to have deliberately surrendered, because, of course, if he's the divine ordained leader of the new world, there's no possibility that he would have made a mistake and just been captured. So I think this is Baghdadi rewriting the history. Now, what I think happened was he got caught up in a sweep like a lot of other people. He hadn't really done a lot of organizing or orchestrating yet, and he probably got more radicalized while being held as a captive. Baghdadi is certainly an opportunist. And so what I think he did was after the fact, he needs an origin story, right? It's usually like the third movie in the superheroes. Okay, you know, you got to tell the backstory of where this guy came from. And in the case of Baghdadi, I think that's really what he's doing. Baghdadi has been very careful to control all of the different ways that he's perceived, particularly in the Muslim world. He had a snafu a few years ago where he was talking about shared sacrifice, and just barely out of his sleeve, you could see a Rolex poking out. And actually, it cost him a lot more support than people would think. Because he was not living up to the standard of we're all facing the same shared sacrifice. Here's a guy that's wearing a luxury watch on his wrist. And so I think what he's doing is just trying to control the narrative of who he is, where he's from, why he's divinely ordained, and why he's never made a mistake. Sir?
Would you say more about the dangers of using robots in warfare?
I would. So here's the thing. The U.S. tends to field technology as fast as we can develop it, and we don't always think through exactly how to use it because we've got this mindset of, we'll figure it out. you know, put it out in the field, figure out how it works, and then we'll figure out what we're doing with it. And sometimes that works pretty well, and sometimes it doesn't, but it's a mechanism, and it's okay. And we've been doing that for 200 years, so that's not a particularly big surprise. The thing is, we've never in human history outsourced killing to anything other than humans. But now, since the 1990s, we've had the capability of fielding autonomous vehicles. These are vehicles that make their own decisions. They fly on their own or they drive on their own, and they choose whether or not to engage in lethal behavior. So this is not just some new advanced technology. In my opinion, this is what's called a revolution in military affairs. It's going to fundamentally transform conflict. And there have been a lot of those in human history. You look back at the development of gunpowder, for example, and what you find is when it first comes out, some people have it, some people don't. It's not inherently better, it's just different. But fast forward a few decades, and you never see a gunpowder-wielding army lose to a non-gunpowder army. It just doesn't happen. And you can look at other revolutions in military affairs and say, look, either you have it or you don't, and sooner or later, everybody adopts it or they go extinct. Military robotics, in my opinion, are going down that same path. When they're remotely operated platforms, it doesn't particularly bother me. When they're defensive platforms, point defense in particular, it also doesn't really bother me. We've been operating fully autonomous systems since the 1980s, if you count air defense platforms. So, for example, the SeaWiz on naval ships, this is a last-ditch defense for inbound missiles. The Patriot missile system, which was so famous in 91, has a fully autonomous mode. And that's where you say, look, this is how enemy airplanes are defined. This is how friendly airplanes are defined. Shoot down anything hostile. There have been a number of occasions where Patriots have engaged friendly aircraft. There have been a number of occasions where friendly aircraft have engaged Patriots in retaliation. You're going to paint me with your radar, I'm going to paint you with mine. You're going to get a weapons lock on me, I'm going to get a weapons lock on you. Luckily, we have not had any specific incidents. But there have been a number of cases of humans being killed by these machines by mistake. So in one particular incident, for example, the South Africans created an air defense gun, and this thing was fully autonomous, and they wanted to show it off because, hey, this thing's great. Invite all the high-ranking people and put them on the bleachers, and we'll show them how great this thing is with live ammunition. And we'll fly some target drones overhead, and it'll shoot them down, and it'll be awesome. So they turn the machine on, and it immediately turns its guns on the bleachers and opens fire. Because it had locked on to what it thought was one of the defined targets. What it was locked on was the motor inside a ventilation fan in the portable bathroom directly behind the bleachers, which happened to be spinning at the same frequency as the fixed-wing aircraft that was supposed to fly overhead and be engaged. 9 people were killed, including a young female lieutenant who charged the gun and pulled the plug on it as it cut her in half. If you don't think through the ramifications of these things and don't take really cautious procedures, you're going to wind up essentially opening up Pandora's box. And right now, the United States is so desperate to minimize its own casualties that we're fielding things to see how well they work. Well, once you show something works, other less scrupulous individuals tend to use them as well. So we showed how effective things like Predators and Reapers could be, flying overhead, firing super accurate missiles, and there is a significant benefit to it. Less casualties, less collateral damage. But the Islamic State went out and bought a bunch of toy helicopters, attached grenades to the bottom of them, and started flying them over friendly positions and just dropping the grenades from about 300 feet up. It's hard to miss if you're just looking through a GoPro camera and dropping it straight down. The Russians, allegedly, I'll go ahead and throw the allegedly out there. I don't work for the Russians, but I don't want them angry. The Russians took the same idea of one of these commercial off-the-shelf technologies, attached a thermite plasma grenade to it, flew it into a Ukrainian ammunition dump, set off the thermite grenade, which is capable of burning through a half inch of steel. That grenade set off a crate of ammunition, which set off a chain reaction that required the evacuation of a city of 200,000 people. It worked so well, the Russians did it again and again and again, which suggests Ukrainian ammo security is not that great. But the point is, we're fielding this stuff and we're testing this stuff you start letting machines kill people without humans involved, where does it stop? And the other question is, if I'm in the Islamic State and I'm getting hit by Predator and Reaper strikes, I don't shoot back at the Predator and Reaper. Bringing that aircraft down, that doesn't do anything for me. That's not worth a whole bunch of publicity. But I also don't just take it. What I do is what people under bombardment have done for the last 1,000 years. I lash out at whatever I can reach, which for them tends to be civilians. I bomb an embassy. I attack tourists. I go after whatever Americans I can find, wherever I can find them, as a means of retaliation. And so what we're effectively doing is not fighting war without risk, but rather shifting risk from our armed personnel who have accepted the risk as part of their service to our unarmed non-combatants who have never agreed to such a risk. You're the Islamic State. Why do you do it that way? Because ultimately you'd like the United States to leave you alone. And if you kill enough Americans, you think the United States government will lose its stomach for the fight. But I'm happy to talk more about it later, too, if anybody wants to hang out. I really bring you down for the whole weekend. Yes, sir. Yeah, the RQ-170 Sentinel that went down in Iran suggests we won't, at least under certain circumstances. I mean, we've lost a lot of Predators and Reapers, and a lot of times it's because of operator error. Occasionally it's because of machine error. Honestly, the technology for those is not as advanced as you'd think. The sensor ball is where the really good stuff is, but the sensor ball tends to be destroyed beyond recovery. But when the RQ-170 Sentinel was mysteriously brought down in Iran, and the Iranians claim they hacked it and caused it to land, they probably spoofed the GPS signal. Essentially, you can broadcast a GPS signal on the same frequency. It doesn't take much power to overwhelm the GPS signal. They fooled it where it was, and it just brought itself in for a landing, thinking it was landing on its base, and in fact, it was landing in Iran, so it's all intact. The Iranians didn't prove to have the technology to reverse engineer it, despite what they claimed. The people they sold it to did, though. Because they sold chunks of it. But the thing is, that's also nothing new. When the Serbs shot down an F-117, one of our stealth fighters, they shot one down, and we thought, good Lord, I thought you could fly those anywhere, and they were perfectly safe. Well, no, it's not a great idea to fly it at the exact same height, the exact same speed, and on the exact same vector every day at the exact same time. The Serbs didn't have to create a new technology. They just had to point a gun and wait, and that's what they did. And the Serbs had no power of reverse engineering it, but they sold it to the Russians and Chinese and massively advanced their programs. And so that's part of my point, is that once you design these technologies, you can't get them back. You've shown that it's doable. When the FBI wanted Apple to hack the iPhone, the Apple company said no, not because they couldn't, but because they knew it was a really bad idea to prove you could. In 1943, we developed the proximity fuse. And that thing is so dangerous that we announce you can only use it over water. Then we accidentally fire a dud shell over Sicily before the invasion of Sicily, and we launch a massive commando raid to go look for a 6-inch shell that fell somewhere in an area of about 4 square miles. To our credit, we found it. But, you want to talk needle in a haystack. Hey, commandos, go behind enemy lines and look for this little ball of steel that's out there somewhere. You'll know it when you find it. Once you create it, you can't get it back. Yes, sir. When's the last time we faced a national emergency where we thought we needed to? World War II. That's part of it. I mean, we created the War Powers Resolution, which was a way for essentially Congress to effectively say, well, you can still go to war, but you need our permission, but this way we can turn it off whenever we want. And presidents have been sort of good about following it, but not 100%. There's no president that loves the War Powers Resolution. They all hate it because it kind of restricts what the Constitution says they can do. We've never seen it openly challenged. There hasn't been a case where we had to actually see it openly challenged. We had sort of a challenge to it in 2011, the incursion into Libya, but the reality was, since we didn't send personnel in, then it didn't really count, right? For me, I think it's Congress is afraid to give any president that power. Because think about it, you know, most presidents have been pretty good about it when given that power. And Roosevelt's the only president that's ever come up for re-election during a declared war. Nobody shout Lincoln, it wasn't a declared war. He's the only one that's come up for re-election during a war, and he chose to run a re-election campaign instead of just announcing, we're suspending elections. But he didn't have to. And there's nothing that says that he couldn't have had his way by just announcing, I'm dictator for life, or until the end of the war. Which it turns out, the end of the war came later than end of life. Oh, we're not going to laugh at FDR's death? I mean, what kind of a crowd are we? Come on. Too soon? You studied the 19th century. 20th century should be fair game. Sir? Told you you wouldn't like it.
No, I haven't.
It doesn't. No, I really can't. That's the problem. I've spent an enormous amount of my professional life for the last 8 years thinking about this problem. It was great when I worked for the Army, because then I could study Army stuff, and it was fun, and I could do POWs. But now I work for the Air Force, and they insist that at least every once in a while I do something they care about, and POWs are not on that list. But go ahead, ask whatever you want, but I will just tell you right now, I cannot see a way in which this turns out well. How much faith do you have in human nature? I am fundamentally a Hobbesian. I think we're all just here to kill each other and take each other's stuff. I'm a pessimist. Other people are more of the Rousseau variety of ultimately we're all good people. The best way it could turn out, honestly, if you could get a prohibitive ban on lethal autonomous offensive weapons, you can't ban defensive ones because they already exist and they're already in use and nobody's going to give them up. But right now, you could still ban autonomous offensive weapons. If you did that prohibitively, the same way that we have a chemical weapons treaty, we have a biological weapons treaty, we have a nuclear non-proliferation treaty, you could hypothetically, at that point, stave off the worst consequences. And yes, there is the possibility that somebody will violate it. Okay? International ban on chemical weapons did not stop Bashar Assad from using chemical weapons. But the international retaliation was unified and effective. So, think back to 1991. The United States, by that point, has said, look, we don't use chemical weapons. We keep a stockpile for research purposes and for Sean Connery movies. We don't use biological weapons, but we keep a stockpile for research purposes. But nukes, those we like. And so we let Saddam Hussein know, hey, by the way, heads up, just so you're aware, if you use any chemical weapons on coalition forces, including Americans, we just so happen to have nuclear Tomahawk cruise missiles in the Gulf on board American battleships. We announced it in public, and we said, look, we will retaliate for chemical weapons with nuclear devices. We did not say against what. We didn't say we'll nuke Baghdad. We just said, have some ambiguity. Enjoy it. And that sometimes works because, yes, one country may adopt these weapons if they're banned, but if the rest of the international community finds that unacceptable, you have other means of retaliation still. Yes. There absolutely is. In fact, you can sign the open letter petition calling for the ban on autonomous lethal weapons if you want. Futureoflife.org. And the kinds of people, it's fascinating to actually go and look at who signed this thing. There are more than 3,000 of the brightest robotics engineers and researchers in the country have signed on and said this is a good idea. It's online. You can sign it yourself. In fact, you go to futureoflife.org, read the letter, and if you agree with it, you click sign the letter. And then there's a second button that says, are you a robotics researcher or not? And you click yes or no as appropriate. And then you can read the list of, I think it's around 20,000 people have signed it now. Dig deep enough, you'll find my name on it. What's that? Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. Thank you, Paul. Really appreciate that.
I had fun. I don't know if anybody else did, but I had fun.
I had some food for thought here. We will see each other tomorrow morning again.